Welcome back to Sea Control. Some of you may have noticed the technical difficulties with last week's audio with the ASPI podcast on land-based anti-ship missiles. We have corrected that error, and we are re-airing that podcast in a less irritating format that doesn't have that weird echo this week. So sit back, relax, and here is ASPI's Sea Control podcast on land-based anti-ship missiles.
And welcome back for another episode of Sea Control, a podcast series brought to you by the Centre of International Maritime Security. I'm Natalie Sandby, and I'm an analyst at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, and I'm the host of the Asia-Pacific series of Sea Control. Today, with me, I've got two guests from ASPI. I've got Lieutenant Colonel Ken Glyman, and I've also got my colleague Harry White. They're both going to join me to discuss the topic of land-based anti-ship missiles, which has been a topic of a recent blog post. But before we get to that, we'll be back after this short break.
Do you like the Sea Control podcast? Sure, we all do. However, we're only a small sea in the ocean of content available to you, our dear listener, at the SimSec website. Sign up for a membership at www.cimsec.org/about/membership. China may have a 9-dash line, but our seas are clear, and we welcome your opinions and articles. Please take a moment while downloading this podcast to leave us a 5-star rating and a comment. We need them. Seriously, how do you think we pay this electric bill? Money?
And welcome back. As I mentioned, we'll be talking about land-based anti-ship missiles, China and the United States today. I'm joined by two guests, my colleagues at ASPI, Ken Glyman and Harry White. Just by a bit of background, Lieutenant Colonel Ken Glyman is an active duty US Army officer, and he joins us at ASPI as a first visiting fellow from US Pacific Command. His research at ASPI focuses on the future of land power and unconventional warfare. He's also a Special Forces officer who's served in numerous assignments in the United States Special Operations Community and at various staff levels from battalion to the Pentagon. He recently achieved the status of PhD candidate from Kansas State University, well done, and is conducting research on support to foreign insurgencies for his dissertation. My colleague Harry White is an analyst at ASPI, and he's written on issues including defense capability, US strategic policy, Iran's nuclear program, and Asian security. He's got a master's degree in international relations from the ANU and the London School of Economics. And before joining ASPI, Harry was a research assistant at the International Institute for Strategic Studies in the UK and was formerly editor of the blog Pinnix. Thank you both for joining me today.
Thank you,
pleasure to be here.
All right, so I've just had a read of your blog post on land-based anti-ship missiles, and you talk about the developments in China as starting the discussion. I was hoping that one of you might bring us up to speed and just give us a little bit of an overview about, you know, what China's developed and what's the significance of that.
Well, there are two parts of the story of China's development which led Ken and I to start looking at land-based anti-ship missiles as an option for Australia and America and our partners in the region. First of all, there's a lot of talk about China's anti-access area denial strategy, the A2AD strategy, and there are different kinds of platforms and capabilities that make that up. But one of them is land-based anti-ship missiles. We hear a lot about the carrier killer missile, the DF-21D anti-ship ballistic missile, but that's part of what is actually a reasonably sort of substantial capability that China has. And the two reasons that that matters for us, the first is that it starts posing risks to the ways that we traditionally project power. It's, you know, it's hard to sail ships around and fly planes off them if somebody can sink them with their missiles. And the other is that maybe they're onto something. Maybe the Chinese have focused in particular on this area because they think that it's an effective way to be able to achieve some operational objectives. And so what that really meant for Ken and I is both that there's pressure on the way that we do things already and that there might be opportunities to do things better.
Right. And, well, if that's the case, if China's developing that, I mean, you've talked about the United States and Australia possibly developing something. Why haven't the United States or Australia or other partners developed anything if China has made these sort of developments thus far?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons. Perhaps the biggest can just be described as path dependence. The United States and Australia and its allies have developed significant overmatch in capabilities from other domains. So when it comes to anti-ship capability, the United States and Australia have a tremendous high-tech, very powerful capability to do that from the air and from the sea. Given that, and also given some geographic remoteness, it just hasn't been necessary. If you think back to when anti-ship artillery was something very important to both of our militaries, you have to go back almost a century and go visit the coastal defense works that are still there and still preserved, and you can see the cannons that used to shoot large shells to protect the coastal waters. That was a big part of what land forces did a century ago. The overmatch that we've developed in air and maritime capability, and when I say maritime, it's also important to remember the subsurface maritime capability, which is tremendous, it just hasn't been cost-effective or necessary. So there really has not been a need for it. Now that we're seeing China's capability and other countries developing this sea denial capability from land-based missiles, it's just making us think that maybe it's time to start looking looking backwards to look forwards.
Right. And which other states in the Asia-Pacific region are developing these capabilities? And, you know, given that China is developing this, are there other states, you think, who might benefit from exploring this option as well?
Well, I'll start with just saying that in terms of our allies and partners, Japan has done this. And if you think about their strategic context, it's made a lot of sense. I mean, they have a self-defense force. The idea of defending their coastal waters, their exclusive economic zones, has made a lot of sense. So they have developed mobile, shorter-range anti-ship missiles like the Type 88 and the new Type 12 missile systems. That's made a lot of sense for them. You can also look at other countries in the region. Taiwan has developed some capability, and I'll let Harry talk about others because there really is a diverse capability coming up around the world in various countries.
Yeah, I mean, and there are a couple of really interesting elements to it. There are different balances of maritime denial capabilities all around the region, though, of course, they're not particularly well developed necessarily in much of Southeast Asia in particular. But the need for these capabilities, it's actually what they're supposed to do is they're supposed to sink ships from land, and that's one way to do it. The other ways you can do it using airplanes, you do it using submarines, you can do it using ships, you can do it using missiles launched from anything you can launch a missile from. But of course, keeping a platform safe and keeping it moving is actually a very demanding task, both technologically and financially. And so if you don't need to bring the weapon system any closer to the target, then all of a sudden you strip out a layer of complexity. This ties into what Ken was saying earlier. That hasn't been a task for the United States because who is going to get near the United States that you'd be firing something from shore? I mean, other than in the strategic nuclear missile sense during the Cold War. But as Asia gets more contested, as the waters have more and more grey ships in them, the options of not needing to project power, but just being able to deny your maritime space from a land-based system is something, actually, I think that lots of countries in the region are going to get interested in.
Right. I mean, as we start to see other states in the Asia-Pacific region starting to explore and possibly develop, in addition to China, Japan and Taiwan, these kinds of capabilities, are there constraints on the developments of these kinds of things? I mean, you both talk about the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, other kinds of instruments that might limit or regulate the development of these capabilities. If that's the case, how important are these kinds of instruments? How important is the treaty?
Well, the treaty is significant to this issue because of the range limitations that it places. So intermediate range would be anything above, in this case what we're talking about, is above 500 kilometers. So that means right now, for example, the U.S. does have rocket artillery, land-based missiles that shoot with a range of far less than under 500. But if you're going to go over 500 kilometers, then you have an intermediate range missile. Now, that range limitation means that by the treaty, we shouldn't be looking at constructing anything like that. However, China's not a signatory to the treaty, and there's some indications that Russia has already violated the treaty.
Oh, but just to be clear, the United States is a current signatory.
The United States and Russia.
Yeah.
And there's another interesting issue comes out. You start looking at the operational requirements, and there are I mean, you know, a missile is not a missile. There are lots of different parameters available here, and range is one of them. And 500 kilometres would still be, I mean, I think the Type 88's range is less than 500 kilometres, but given Japan's operational environment, that still provides them with a capacity to protect themselves. You know, that works for the operations that they'd like to be able to achieve success in. In an Australian context or in a broader American context, you start seeing there's a greater premium that intuitively it seems like it might be worth us paying in order to get longer range. In an Australian context, 1,000 kilometres would be pretty good, actually. And, you know, anything that we developed in partnership with the United States would obviously run up against that INF treaty. And so what you start doing here is looking at all sorts of costs and benefits to developing this type of system, whether or not a country like Australia or America or whoever was going to develop it jointly, what kind of parameters you'd emphasise, like range, like speed, like stealth. And all that is intimately connected to exactly what kind of operations you think you need these to be able to achieve.
Ken, did you want to add anything to
that? That very much explains it. Now, the question becomes, is it worth violating or getting rid of the treaty in order to do that? And that's part of what we're examining right now.
Yeah, do you get enough benefit out of the difference between 500 and 1,000 or 1,500 to be worth the cost of violating that treaty? And if you look at some of the distances in the second island chain, I mean, let's face it, we're talking about conflict in the Western Pacific here. You can do a lot for your maritime denial capability by being able to fire a missile about 450 kilometres, but there are some serious options that you give yourself by going further. So we'll be exploring that in greater depth, hopefully. It's a complicated issue.
Just on that, just to note that Harry and Ken are developing a research paper on this topic as well, so we'll certainly be able to make that available. Actually, Harry, I'm really glad that you brought up the Australian context, because in response to the blog post that you published, there was a current serving Australian Army officer who wrote back, Mark Askoff, and he said, look, it's all well and good for us to be exploring this kind of capability, but there are kind of challenges ahead. I mean, one of the things he says is that there's an evolution in strategic culture that's required, and also there might be some unintended consequences, some flow-on effects in the political and military landscape amongst Asia-Pacific states. Look, I mean, it's great to have that engagement. I just wanted to get your thoughts on what his feedback was. I mean, are there challenges inherent to the strategic culture question?
Absolutely. Mark is right in his response, especially when he makes the point that there's more to capability than just the equipment. There's concepts, and once there are concepts, there's a lot more to it. For example, just saying land-based anti-ship missiles, that does not a capability make. That is a hardware part of a capability. But within a capability, that should fit into a concept. And a concept is really how we fight, how we're going to fight, or how we think we're going to fight. And then from the development of a concept, you really have to consider all the elements that go into a capability, which would be, the U.S., we say the first thing is doctrine. Australia has a very similar framework for it, but you have to think about the personnel. Who's mm-hmm. going to man these things? How are they going to be trained? How are they going to interoperate and function with the rest of the military? And that becomes a tough question. Now, to Mark's point about the strategic and, I would say, institutional culture of the ADF, there is a difficulty there, what I would call on the seams. So when we're talking about inter-domain warfare, might be the best way to say it, we're talking about joint operations inter-domain. We've heard about air-sea battle. Really, if you're talking in the context of the Pacific, you're talking about air, sea, and land battle, and all of these organizations fighting together. That also means they have to develop capabilities together. Much of the capabilities development, whether it's in the U.S. or the ADF, is service-driven. So who owns it? So when you start talking about air defense, who owns it? Do the planes defend the air, or should we be defending them from the ground? If they come from the ground, who owns that capability? When you start getting on the seams and that interaction, the service culture gets in the way, and which is one reason why in ASPE's, they did a report on special operations, where recognizing that a lot of special operations is an inter-domain thing, that it was really necessary to have a joint capabilities manager at the ADF. So that would be one thing that would add to Mark's argument.
Yeah, and just to add that, I mean, Mark is doing something I think is very valuable, which is thinking about what kind of contribution we would want from the different services to achieve our objectives, depending on where we define our strategic interests. And they were talking about an archipelagic kind of vision of Army's future as one way to go. And that's important because, of course, it's to do with our strategy. Where do we want to be able to use armed force and to what ends in exactly what operational environments? And that's a very big question. We couldn't answer the whole thing here. But if that is the part of the world in which the Australian Army wants to operate in the future, then actually being able to, you know, fire some anti-ship missiles would probably be a pretty useful thing.
I'd like to stick on the Australian military for a second and actually come back to this idea of concepts. The ADF so far has a couple of concepts. We haven't gone down the land-based anti-ship missile route yet, but we've got the joint archipelagic concept. Harry, I think you wrote a little bit something about that. I'd like you both, if you can, just introduce what that is for international listeners and perhaps, you know, if you can sort of give that a bit of a critique, that'd be great.
So the joint archipelagic maneuver, it's a little hard to say sometimes, but it's a good concept because that's what it is. It's a future concept trying to get a grasp on how Australia might fight or need to fight in the future. The idea of archipelagic maneuver would mean operating in an environment categorized by a littoral region where you had to have mobility and firepower, and you had to be able to move them from island to island in order to control the sea domain between them and to deny that to an adversary. But if you think about what that would require, that's the beauty of the concept, because the concept is nice, it's big, and then it allows you to dive down into some details, maybe even play it out in some scenarios. And suddenly you find the real problems and the real challenges that you're going to have to face in terms of capability. If you're going to hop things from island to island, you're going to need the air to do it, you're going to need the coastal and littoral craft to do it, you're going to need the logistics to support that, you're going to need a culture that's ready to do that, you might even need forced entry capability. I mean, this starts to bring up a lot of questions. So it's just a concept, and concepts are good because they allow you to really think through these problems and then apply them to actual capability solutions.
And this is a relatively new concept that's been introduced by the Army.
I think it is, in the sense that, you know, maneuvering in a littoral region is not new by any means. Doing it in combined arms is not new. But the idea of how this can be done now and in the future, there's a lot of pieces to that are new, because the ADF isn't designed to do that right now. So what changes would you need to make to the ADF in terms of culture, hardware, people, etc., to make that concept reality?
Just to underscore the contrast between what the ADF is currently able to do and what that, you know, the aspiration might be, what is the ADF structured to do right now? What do you think it's sort of best able to grasp?
Well, it's interesting because what the ADF... So what is it best able to do? That's an interesting question to pose to an American. But the ADF is...
Don't say support America.
You know, much of the ADF's deployments have been to contribute to a coalition effort. And, you know, the current efforts in Iraq are actually kind of amazing to see how much Australia is able to contribute proportionally. I mean, given the size of Australia... Given the fact that they're able to move and deploy everything to Iraq on their own, it's actually a big deal. It shows that Australia does have this kind of global reach to be a real important part of a coalition. But there's other capabilities in the region that Australia is clearly interested in. I think Harry can talk a little bit more about those in general.
Sure. I'm going to swing it back a little bit to the joint archipelagic maneuver concept, Harry. I know you've written a little bit about that. So we've talked a little bit about, you know, where we are currently and the aspiration. What do you think about that concept?
Well, I think what Ken was talking about the operational specifics, gets really interesting. Exactly the sort of thing that's driving China's rise and our tension about China militarily and operationally in the Western Pacific is that it's so hard to keep surface ships afloat against capable adversaries these days. And that's what has driven that's why air-sea battle is such a big step. It's such a big escalation, because you have to take control in order to keep anything safe at all on the surface of the water. that has ramifications right down to Australia's little archipelago, plans, because if we want to be able to move around, it's really hard to keep ships afloat these days. And so it means that there's a greater premium on air mobility, for example, which is complicated, which means that you also want to be able to deny other people's means of projecting power, because the better they can project power, the more likely they are going to be able to target and sink your own, vessels and damage your own forces. And so you need... One of the ways in which this archipelago manoeuvre is an old thing, but it looks new, is it's going to have to rely less on big ships than it did in the past. And that was always the way, that you took a hardened position, is you get a couple of big ships and you put a lot of people in one place straight away. And that now presents a very tempting target for exactly the kind of munitions that we're looking to develop. So there's a lot of thinking to be done about how you would manage serious size archipelagic operations in the future. It's going to be very complicated.
Absolutely.
I'm actually going to stray from the script just for a second. I can see a look of concern in both their eyes. what I would like to get into is a little bit of a short discussion that we've had amongst some of our colleagues in Australia about Australia as a top 20 defence player. Yes, Harry, I had to bring that up. And it's an interesting question because in Australia we're having this debate at the moment. Are we a top 20 nation? Are we a top 20 defence player? I wanted to ask each of you what you think that means and whether there's any utility to that concept or is there a better way?
Can I go first?
So absolutely.
Ken can take the bitter taste out of everybody's mouth. I think that there's a sort of pejorative sense. When we say top 20 player, that's really code for really big player when people say it. It's got this kind of, get this kind of glow and you stare admiringly up at the flag or putting your hand on your heart. But actually, there are very few nations in the world which can seriously shape the strategic environment. What nations can do is significantly raise the costs and risks for people of violating their interests. So, Australia can make it a really big deal for anybody to do things directly to us that we don't want them to do. Shaping the way other people behave is a huge job. It's even difficult for America. And so I think you can say, yes, we are a top 20 defence player. Of course we are. We have a big defence expenditure. I think we're in the top 13 or 14 on defence expenditure. We have very professional and very capable armed forces, and it's still very difficult to do things. And so what I think it's important is not to say, oh, no, we're not a big deal. It's to realise just how big a deal it is to be able to shape other actors' behaviour.
Well, I would agree. I think that when Harry says, it's even difficult for the United States to shape behaviour or to change an order, to use military force to change something, it's becoming more and more that the United States and its military power is a necessary but not sufficient condition to make a change. Well, if you have countries like Australia, they fill that gap. The U.S. might be necessary, but additionally, you need allies who are going to contribute to the effort, make a real contribution to the effort. Flying a flag at a headquarters is a great symbolism, but it is not enough. And in order to do that, we need countries that are going to bring real capability. Australia does that. So I think that's a fair statement to say, that a top 20 military power, it makes sense. Now, in terms of expenditure, that's one thing. Of course, both our militaries have the issue that we spend a lot, and a lot of that is just on personnel. Personnel are expensive, so we don't necessarily have a lot of mass, but we might have a lot of overmatch when it comes to technology and the quality of the people that are actually employed in our militaries, and that affects the way we fight.
I think there's another really important point here, which is, so when if we're feeling confident militarily, we're saying, Australia, we're going to spend more, we can do a lot, we shouldn't underestimate ourselves. All that's true. But that doesn't get you out of having to set objectives which you can achieve with the force available. And that is really important. There's a tendency to say, because we think we can do something well, we can do anything well. But some stuff is just not a military problem. And some things are military problems but aren't able to be achieved.
Can you give me an example of where you think that might have happened in the past?
Oh, where it might happen in the past? Well, there's this little place I like to call the Middle East where we haven't exactly achieved all of our military objectives. It's complicated. And it's not immediately clear to me, for example, that the degrade and destroy objective was phrased very well by Obama. If he meant something else, he should have said something else. And if he meant degrade and destroy, then that's going to look like a pretty ambitious target, to do from the air, and it means, actually you can't do it without ground forces. And so that's an example of an objective which was either misspoken or was over-ambitiously set. And I think that we can be confident You know, there are lots of things that we can do, but we need to make sure that we're setting objectives which are within those very substantial means, you know, and both as Australia and as partners in coalition with the United States and others.
Well, fingers crossed that gets all articulated well in the Defence White Paper 2015.
I have no doubt.
Neither do I. And I'd just like to end on a final note with you, Ken. You know, we've been very happy to have you at ASPE embedded with us for the next couple, well, for the past 2 months and for a little while longer. Coming from PACOM down and being in Canberra, you've been able to meet with, you know, Defence Force personnel, talk to other strategic thinkers. I just wanted to get your impressions of what Australian strategic culture is like, or anything else that struck you as an American you know, military officer and looking from the outside in.
Well, that's a question that I've had many conversations about. Definitely being dropped into a different strategic context. And I think I mentioned to you earlier, I'm working on a paper right now called American Strategist in Canberra, because there have been a lot of these moments where I came in as a strategist, having lived and worked in a very different strategic context in terms of the United States, and then coming to Canberra, you suddenly are looking at Australia's strategic context. And you think you know, but you're going to spend a little time here. Working at ASPE, though, I tell you, is absolutely fantastic. It's this is a wonderful organization, and the think tank culture here is very strong. Coming into that environment was very nice in and of itself, to be among people who see their job as to inform the discourse on defense and security, but also to do real hard research. So that's a very nice thing about Canberra. I'd also say that there's a lot of different things that have made an impression on me. The first is the size and the scale. So you can look at that in a lot of ways, the size and the scale of Australia, its remoteness, but also just the size and the scale of the military and of your security forces. It really does force some hard choices. And that is a really healthy thing for a strategist from any country to have to think about. I'm not sure that as a strategist in the United States, we've been very disciplined about that, just as military strategists. Here, you've got to recognize that some capabilities are not worth building or having, and you have to take some risks and accept that, you know, maybe your friends and allies are going to cover that capability if you cover this capability. So that's been an interesting piece. I will say one other thing that I find interesting. I did not think that the United States military was as open about the discourse as it is. I find that the Australian Defence Force is a little bit less open among its own people.
Just about
writing and publishing, for example. I feel very fortunate that the U.S. has given me this opportunity to come here. But my parameters or my restrictions are actually very open, so to speak. I only need to disclose that I'm an active duty U.S. Army officer. That my opinions are my own, and then of course I'm responsible for my opinions. So if I say anything particularly outlandish or offensive, I have to suffer the consequences for that. But I do see that within Australia, it's a little bit tighter here, which I think is an interesting thing. Anything that an Australian officer publishes, you know, needs to be cleared by a general officer.
And I think, you know, getting a chance to work with Ken while he's been here, it's been fantastic for us to benefit from that combination of, you know, your personal accountability so you can express what you want to express, but also with your experience and the fact that you'll continue to serve. I mean, that's been a very valuable experience for us here at ASPE. And I think that, it really adds a lot to the sort of strength of US discourse. It's important to be able to... Some ideas, obviously, have to remain out of the public domain.
Absolutely.
But many ideas benefit from the light of day, and I think it really helps.
I agree, and I think that's an important part of what ASPE's doing, and I think that there's what I have noticed about working with the ADF is I have met with tens of officers and young employees who have had some really brilliant ideas that they want to talk about and that they want to get out there. And so I think that there's a lot of talent, strategic talent, entrepreneurial strategic talent within the ADF that needs to come out.
Yeah, I think from our experiences in the blogosphere, I think Harry and I would agree that's something that we would like to see much more of, a much healthier discourse between not only Australian military personnel amongst themselves, but also with our allies and partners overseas.
And civilians where possible in the defence and security space.
Absolutely.
But I think that they face similar challenges.
Yeah, no, we benefit from that exchange immensely. Mm. And from my conversations over up the road, I think the sense is that's on a positive trajectory so far, but the change is small, and we do look at the American case as the openness within the strategic community there is as probably as a benchmark for us, but hopefully that's something we can report on in future.
Absolutely, definitely.
But for now, we'll just round off our discussion. We started with land-based anti-ship missiles. We talked a little bit about the significance of that for the Asia-Pacific, why the United States and Australia haven't gone down that route yet, but what that balance might mean, where other players are actually developing that capability as well. We talked a little bit about Australian strategic culture, what we could do as a modest defence player. And ultimately, we finished with some of Ken's thoughts on the differences between America and Australia, and a little bit about, open discourse there amongst our military and civilians. So, gentlemen, thanks so much for joining me again today. And to our listeners, thank you again for joining us. And don't forget, you can download this podcast and many of our great past ones from Matthew Hipple and Alexander Clark on iTunes or from the SimSec website at simsec.org. Thanks again.